I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. With less than 3 weeks until Philadelphia hosts the Democratic National Convention, the U.S. Secret Service has mapped out road closures and other restrictions during the event. Though if you're starting to feel the same dread from last September's papal visit, WHYY's Katie Culinary reports, you can relax.
Here's the good news. Unlike the papal visit, there will be no traffic restrictions in Center City, and all major highways, including I-95, will be open to passenger vehicles, although some exit ramps will be closed. But if you live in South Philadelphia, near the Wells Fargo Center where the DNC is being held, that's a different story.
Obviously, if you live down there, there'll be significant traffic in the way of police activity and obviously delegate buses and things like that.
At a news conference with city, state, and federal officials, Philadelphia Police Commissioner Richard Ross told reporters the department is trying to make it bearable.
I'm not going to be misleading and say there'll be no impact, but we're going to try to minimize that as much as possible.
Ross also took questions about how the city will handle possibly tens of thousands of protesters. About 400 demonstrators were arrested during violent clashes with police when Philadelphia hosted the Republican National Convention in 2000. Despite assurances it's trying to avoid a repeat of that event, many civil libertarians are concerned the city won't keep its word. Ross says the department is working with activist groups ahead of the convention, and protesters won't see police dressed in riot gear. A new city law also allows police to issue $100 fines for certain nuisance crimes rather than making arrests.
We don't really have an interest in criminalizing a bunch of people who are out peacefully protesting.
Ross says some Philadelphia police officers are going to Cleveland for the Republican National Convention the week before the DNC to observe and get ready. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
Check out newsworks.org for a map of road closures during the DNC. A Pennsylvania judge denies Bill Cosby's effort to compel the accuser in his criminal sex assault case to testify before trial. On hand at the Montgomery County Courthouse in Norristown, and joining me to make sense of today's proceedings is WHYY's Bobby Allen. Good evening, Bobby.
Hey, Dave. How's it going?
The issue seems to revolve around a type of secondhand testimony and whether it can be used as evidence before this trial.
Yeah, exactly. So Cosby's attorneys today argued that Mr. Cosby, his due process rights were trampled on because he didn't have the opportunity to confront his accuser at a May preliminary hearing, which is a key stage in the criminal justice process before a defendant is bound over for trial. Today, the judge said, actually, he will have that opportunity at trial, and he doesn't have to confront his accuser before that stage.
Again, the accuser is Andrea Constand. And Cosby is accused of drugging and molesting her at his home near Philadelphia in 2004. What's likely to happen next?
So coming up in 2 weeks, Mr. Cosby will have a formal arraignment in which the charges will be formally read to him, and he will enter a plea. After that, both sides will be able to file motions, and if motions are denied from Cosby's team can appeal them, then he can appeal the appeals. So this is not to say that a trial is going to be happening anytime soon, but from a procedural standpoint, this does bring us a wee bit closer to that trial.
Is it likely that this case could go all the way up to the state Supreme Court?
Now, that's what Cosby's counsel is saying, that they're going to fight this all the way to the highest terminal appellate court in Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. But it should be noted that there is another case right now that is looking at this second, third-hand testimony question, also known as hearsay testimony, and we're expecting oral arguments on that different case sometime this fall. And it also should be noted that the state Supreme Court rejects some, like 9 out of 10 petitions it receives. So the likelihood that they will take another question on hearsay and this particular question on hearsay, according to most legal scholars I talked to, is not very likely. But of course, Cosby's counsel says they're going to vigorously fight and keep appealing and keep appealing and keep appealing.
Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY's Bobby Allen offering perspective. Over the holiday weekend, SEPTA assembled a contingency plan to keep its regional rail service moving. This after structural deficits sidelined nearly one-third of its train cars. Now the transit agency will turn its attention to possible remedies in the boardroom and the courtroom as it considers its options through warranties or litigation with the manufacturer Hyundai Rotem. Bland Philly's Jim Saxa joins me now with a look ahead. Jim, how will SEPTA's decisions pursuing the warranty or litigation affect the time frame for restoring the system?
Well, Dave, they actually won't. SEPTA has about 4 years to decide whether or not they want to pursue any sort of litigation against the manufacturer or anyone else. In the interim, SEPTA is not going to really want to talk about lawsuits. What they're going to want to focus on is fixing or replacing these equalizer bars, the parts that were cracked. And to do that, they're going to want to work with the manufacturer, Hyundai Rotem, as much as possible and as closely as possible. Then once the cars are up and running, which they don't know how long that's going to take, it could take months, could take a lot of months, then they'll start focusing for real on whether or not they want to pursue legal action.
In the process of seeking bids for the cars, SEPTA was mandated to accept the lowest responsible bid, and it brings to mind the balance between safety and budget.
Yeah. When this bid originally went out, there was another company, Kawasaki, that their bid was just slightly higher, but they also had a much higher technical engineering score. Hyundai Rotem was a very green company. They had not built any rail cars of this type in America before, and they had the lowest engineering score. And essentially, there was a lot of back and forth and involved a lawsuit, but in the end, SEPTA went with the cheaper, less experienced company.
Now, to the extent that the defects were found in some one-third of the cars, what assurances are there that the same problem won't develop down the road?
Well, so the one-third of the cars have been taken out of service already, and those were all the cars that were built in just the last couple of years by Hyundai Rotem. The rest of SEPTA's regional rail fleet were built years before and have a completely different design for the part that broke, a much more sturdy design. In the wake of the news breaking, SEPTA stepped up its inspections of all its rail cars, and so far they haven't had any problems.
Bland Philly's Jim Saxa on Newsworks Tonight. Still ahead this evening, a youth sports league celebrates 5 years of providing a summer respite for kids in a tough city.
Well, we've had coaches who have lost family members to the violence. We've had players who have lost brothers, sisters to the violence. Some of our coaches have lost their parents due to violence.
We'll visit the Camden Neighborhood Baseball and Softball Association as Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Wade Waxland served 20 years in the United States Navy, including more than 3 years at the Naval Air Station Joint Reserve Base in Willow Grove. That military site was designated a Superfund site in 1995, and when the former naval air crewman was diagnosed with bladder cancer in 2012, a doctor told Wade and his wife Nicole that he likely had been exposed to something that had caused his illness. Let's pick up the story from there with Nicole Waxland. Nicole, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
I understand that you submitted a letter from that doctor with a claim for benefits a couple of months later in 2012. What happened?
We submitted a claim in October of 2012 for disability based upon the cancer diagnosis that he was exposed to chemicals while serving in the military. That process took over a year.
Your husband passed in December of 2013, and apparently 1 month prior, the VA denied that initial claim for benefits. How do they substantiate denying that claim?
Not enough sufficient evidence was their statement.
Putting the onus on you in this case to gather more evidence?
Correct. We needed to connect the dots of the exposures that he was exposed to in the military to the cancer. At that point in time, we did some research, and we came up with chemicals that he was exposed to in his daily work life. And during that time frame, we had found out that NASJRB Willow Grove, which was in Horsham, Pennsylvania, was also a Superfund site. Once we found that out, we did extensive research about the chemicals at the base and found that those chemicals cause cancer or carcinogenics. And from there, we just gathered evidence on a monthly basis, submitted this evidence to the VA to reopen our claim.
Was the VA and or the military in general helpful in the process of you gathering this evidence, or was it more of an adversarial relationship?
I don't want to say adversarial, but there was no help on their side. Unfortunately, there are not a lot of resources out there as a veteran when situations like this present themselves. We were not made aware by the military or the Veterans Administration or the state that that base was a Superfund site. We found that out on our own by doing research, which is unfortunate because, you know, there's several hundreds of people that have been to that base that might not necessarily live in the vicinity of that base any longer and could have ailments that are unaware that this is actually happening in Horsham.
And I understand to try to make that connection with the hundreds who potentially were also exposed, you established a private Facebook group.
That is correct. Once we recognized that this was a lot bigger than just my husband, Wade wanted to reach out to his fellow shipmates and say, hey, you know, this is happening. What's going on with you? So we established the Facebook page to disseminate the information that we had gathered, and it just snowballed.
Ultimately, though, you had to turn to an independent facilitator, contractor, to move the case forward?
Yes, this is correct. The VA system, in my opinion, is set up for failure for the claimant. It is very hard to navigate, and I was lost. I was grieving my husband. I was trying to raise three children who didn't have a father, and was given this case and said, okay, if you want to appeal it, you can appeal it. How do I appeal it? And so I did some research online and found an independent consultant. It was probably the best decision I made because I would not have been able to do it without that consultant, unfortunately.
Will the hard work that you did to get to the result ultimately benefit others who, through Facebook, for example, can look into other opportunities to move their cases forward?
I hope so. I hope that this process and his claim becoming approved sets precedence in some sort, whether as they clear up the system and make it easier for veterans to navigate, or they acknowledge that this site, this Superfund site, has chemicals that do cause cancer in veterans.
Nicole Waxland, thanks so much for sharing your experience with our listening audience.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nicole Waxland, and you can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. This season, the Camden Neighborhood Baseball and Softball Association is eight times as big as when the Youth Sports League started in North Camden 5 years ago. Elizabeth Fiedler profiles the coaches who are making sure that kids in a tough city have a chance to take the field.
The weather at Pine Point Park in North Camden is absolutely perfect. A slight breeze, bright warm sunshine, and a huge well-tended field just waiting for baseball. It's enough to make adults wish they were teenagers again.
I love working with the youth and just helping them and seeing, like, no matter what you're going through, no matter what you're trying to do, there's always a way out.
Standing at the edge of the field, our Jenes Calderon is dressed in a black t-shirt and jeans, with a gold chain hanging around his neck. He's ready to coach a bunch of 13 to 15-year-olds who make up his Yankees team. He calls them his boys.
Baseball was my way out, so I guess I'm giving back to the sport that gave me so much.
Calderon's only 20. His mom dropped him off in the family minivan for the interview. Looking out of the well-manicured field, he explains that when he started playing baseball, around the age of 11, he hated it.
I was so bad at the sport that, like, I remember one practice, I was doing so bad I cried in the middle of the practice, and I left. And I said, I quit. I'm not playing baseball ever again. Never. My mom pulled me to the side and said, look, I paid for you to play baseball. You're going to play baseball. So I just kept playing, and eventually, during high school, I think I was top 25 in my junior year in South Jersey batting.
It's a great personal success story that Calderon tells to motivate his own players. This is exactly what Brian Morton hoped would happen. He founded the North Camden Little League in 2011, and it was a big deal, in one of the most dangerous parts of one of the most dangerous cities. There were stray bullets and fears of getting caught in the crossfire. Morton knew all that, but he pushed forward anyway. And now...
My hope is that the magic in a bottle is not just confined to North Camden, and that by summer's end, seven neighborhoods will collectively be working toward changing the city so that kids have an opportunity just to be kids.
The season strategically starts in June, when school ends, to keep players occupied with a positive activity. Morton says Argenis Calderon, the young coach, is a true role model for the players.
It's teenage boys that are being recruited and being targeted by the gang. So to have a young man such as Argenis leading our Major League Baseball program is awesome.
Morton points out that the young coach is a Rutgers Camden student who's staying engaged in his community. Often, college students from Camden distance themselves from their neighborhood.
Socially, you're not hanging around, and professionally, you're looking for opportunities outside of the city.
A few minutes' drive away, the field on 10th Street is less fancy. There are two soccer goals with no nets pushed to the far end, a building with peeling paint on the other side. Softball coach Shirley Irizarry is just arriving for practice with a bucket full of balls.
I coach the Lady Flames and the Liberty Bells.
She has two daughters, and a few years ago she started coaching. She knew nothing about softball, but has learned the fundamentals. During the week, she runs straight home from work at the school district, changes, and hits the field.
It's very hectic and busy, but I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Irizarry's doing this because she hopes softball will help these young women raise their self-esteem and learn useful life skills about how to be part of a team and be disciplined.
We're really big about building sisterhood. Even though we're on opposite teams, we try to make sure that we keep the community feeling, the sisterhood feeling, and that's because we just want better for them, and we want them to become involved in the community.
In Camden, danger is never far from your mind. The field the girls play on is named after an 11-year-old softball player who was killed by a stray bullet while at a birthday party. Irizarry knows that girl could have been any of her players.
Well, we've had coaches who have lost family members to the violence. We've had players who have lost brothers, sisters to the violence. Some of our coaches have lost their parents due to violence. And it's just too much of a common theme for us not to bring attention to it.
This league has become a support system for the players, coaches, and families. It helps everybody cope with the setbacks life deals them and provides a chance to celebrate moments of pure joy. For WHYY, I'm Elizabeth Fiedler.
Finally this evening, in Philadelphia Tonight, a dance company will perform an original work on the site where, in 2013, a Salvation Army thrift store building collapsed, killing six. The pop-up performance is part of a series of dances by Korean choreographer Youngwoon Kim about the sudden loss of loved ones. Another dance about the sinking of a Korean passenger ferry in 2014 will be performed in Dilworth Plaza Sunday. One of Kim's collaborators is Jermaine Ingram, who explains the dance.
Creating a kind of permission for those who are left behind to express their feelings, whether it's anger, a sense of loss or grief or love or questioning. Very often when people die suddenly, it tends to shut down emotion. Can art open up the space for constricted emotions to come forward?
Both this evening's and Sunday's dances will inform a longer work to be performed at Philadelphia's Asian Arts Initiative in October. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Tomorrow evening, we'll visit the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, where a new exhibit explores American politics through art. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.